Welcome to the Mill Creek View, Tennessee podcast with your host, Steve Abramowitz, editor-in-chief of the Mill Creek View newspaper.
Howdy, y'all. I'm Steve Abramowitz, and this is the Mill Creek View podcast. We are focusing on the volunteer state and our nation today with always an interesting person making a positive change in our community. This time, special guest, Dr. Art Laffer. And welcome to our People in the News, where I interview people who are making an impact and are lovers of truth. Today, we are talking with Dr. Art Laffer. Dr. Laffer is the founder and chairman of Laffer Associates, an economic research and consulting firm. Dr. Laffer has distinction in many publications as the father of supply-side economics from 1981 to 1989 and was a founding member of the Reagan Executive Advisory Committee for the presidential race of 1980. He also advised Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher on fiscal policy in the UK during the 1980s. In 2019, Dr. Laffer was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom by President Donald Trump. Dr. Laffer currently sits on the boards of a number of private and public policy companies and has authored numerous books, including An Inquiry into the Nature and Causes of the Wealth of States, Wiley, 2014, and Taxes Have Consequences, An Income Tax History of the United States, released by Post Hill Press in September 2022. Dr. Laffer received a BA in economics from Yale University in 1963. He received an MBA and a PhD in economics from Stanford University in 1965 and 1972, respectively. Dr. Laffer is the author of a number of books, including The End of Prosperity, How High Taxes Will Doom the Economy If We Let It Happen. He was noted in Time Magazine's March 29th, 1999 cover story, The Century's Greatest Minds, for inventing the Laffer Curve, which it seemed one of a few of the advances that powers this extraordinary century. Wow. All right. Well, we are pleased to have him here to explain all this stuff to us. Hello, Dr. Laffer. How are you today?
Very well. And thank you very much for reading exactly what my mom wrote about me. That was very, very nice of you, Steve.
I called her and she said, don't get it wrong.
I thought this was the Heartland Journal today.
It is. It is. It will be next week, as a matter of fact. But you're the first of the one of the last of the Mill Creek View, Tennessee podcast.
Oh, okay. I thought it was the first of the Heartland Journal ones. Okay. Well,
I know it's confusing.
Thank you.
That's a bumper shoot that we'll be adding into future shows. But as for today, we are still the Mill Creek View, Tennessee podcast. And for one
100%
more,
100% with you.
Okay. Good for you. So you and I have something in common: University of Southern California, and we both live in Tennessee. Tell me why Tennessee, before we get into all the nitty-gritty of economics, why Tennessee was where you decided to call home?
It is the nitty-gritty of economics. I came here because it's the lowest tax state in the nation, period. And if there's one thing I've got to do with my profession is I've got to stay true to my morals and my codes. And so when I left Southern California, I looked at all the other 49 states, and I picked the single lowest tax state in the nation to move to. Now, I came here not knowing much about it. Now, I'd visited here a couple of times and stuff like that. But when I got here, I not only was very pleased with the tax situation, which is wonderful, but I also really like the state. I like Nashville. I like what I do here. And it's just wonderful. So it's been a win-win-win for me all the way around.
Exactly right. That's exactly what I did. I did the math. I did the dollars per square foot. I did the property taxes. And I said, hey, that's the lowest. Let's go there. All right.
Exactly right. By the way, we do have a lot in common. Now, what were you doing at USC?
Graduating with a degree in film and literature that I don't really use.
So you
until
were in
now.
The Annenberg Center, Annenberg?
Yes, sir. Drew Casper was one of my professors.
Oh,
and
wow.
Yeah. Now my new screenwriter, Howie Klausen, is reunited, and we are trying to make Heartland movies.
Fantastic. Well, I loved USC too. I was the Charles B. Thornton professor there in economics and business, and so I just loved it. I mean, what a great place, except for the rotten taxes.
The rotten taxes, that's right. And it's gotten worse since you and I left.
If you wiggled, they taxed you. If you slept, they taxed you. If you did, I mean, goodness gracious.
Yeah, we complained about parking costs, but now it's the taxation too. But I, you know, left there in, 93 and moved on to another no-tax state, Washington State, but their politics went nasty too. And so now back to Tennessee, where welcome to America. Where you and I can actually talk.
I love it. I love it.
Horror stories. So here's my thesis. You tell me what you think, because you're way smarter than I am. Nixon, Ford, Rumsfeld, Cheney, Kissinger, detente. Reagan and Carter were outsiders. He there was a very contentious election with Reagan and Ford that ended up with Carter becoming president. Do you agree with that? And do you think we're still living in the Nixon, Ford, Rumsfeld, Cheney, Kissinger era?
Well, those are all facts. And by the way, almost all of those people, with the exception of Carter, were really very, very close friends. Cheney was a classmate of mine at Yale. Don Rumsfeld was one of my dearest friends ever. Obviously, I worked in the Reagan with Reagan throughout the whole 8 years of his presidency. And what you saw happen in 1976 was a battle between Jerry Ford and Ronald Reagan. And what it showed you, or at least it showed me, was the hugely powerful incumbency of a sitting president, that they really can shake the election down. And that is exactly what happened. I think Reagan lost by 11 delegates, and then Jerry Ford was the nominee, and then Jerry Ford was trounced by Jimmy Carter. And then reverse 1980, Ronald Reagan trounced Jimmy Carter, and the greatest era of the universe of America, the skies cleared, the sun shone forth on the earth, the plants, they grew lusciously, the trees flowered and bore fruit, the animals multiplied, the children danced in the streets, and you know, we had a peaceful, prosperous period of Ronald Reagan. And it was peaceful. It was prosperous. There were no major riots in America in the 8 years of Reagan, as opposed to everyone else. You know, the world was much more a pro-America world. And God, was it fun, wasn't it?
Yes. Yeah, so, well, I was a little bit young then, but I left USC 5 years before you, after you got there. But in 1976, you know, Reagan's speech at the Republican convention, where he lost and Ford and Dole were nominated and later lost to Carter, he spoke of a time capsule to be opened in 100 years. All right. That would have been 2076, which we're not there yet. We are halfway there. The key line for me was, the freedoms we have known up until now will depend on what we do here. Will they look back with the appreciation and say, thank God for those people in 1976 who headed off that loss of freedom, who kept us now 100 years later free, who kept our world from nuclear destruction? And if we fail, they probably won't get to read the letter at all, because it spoke of individual freedoms and they won't be allowed to talk of that or read of it. Are we halfway to freedom or destruction today?
You know, the world is a very complicated and complex system. And what happens is really something I can't see very clearly. You know, Reagan was amazing during the era in which we had that prosperity and 8 years of prosperity. And by the way, I also voted for Bill Clinton. Just for the record, he was great president as well. Not quite such a great man as Reagan was, but it was George Herbert Walker Bush that was the real problem, sort of the sandwich in the middle, if you will, the bologna in the middle of the two good pieces there. But, you know, I worry about America. I worry about it. But then I look at what the highest tax rate was when we came into office with Reagan. The highest marginal income tax rate back then was 70%. When he left office, it was 28%. The corporate rate was 46%. When he left office, it was 34%. We went from 11 tax brackets when Reagan came into office to 2 tax brackets when he left office. If you look at it now, we've got a huge amount of the legacy of Reagan still with us. I mean, the highest personal income tax rate is 37%, which it's not, you know, it's not 28%, but it's damn good by historical standards. The corporate rate, because of Donald Trump, it's 21%. So it's even better than the corporate rate under Reagan. So, you know, there are a lot of ifs, ands, and buts, but inflation when we came into office on January 20th, 1981, the prime interest rate in the U.S. was 21.5%. Can you believe that, Steve? Can
you imagine? I own treasuries.
Yeah, well, can you imagine what the world would look like today with a 21.5% prime? So when you look at it, there are a lot of pluses and minuses, but Reagan really was the culmination of a long revolution. And if you look at that long revolution, and this is in our book, by the way, my co-authors were Brian Dmitrievich and Gene Sinkfield. They're the co-authors, both doctors as well. My type of doctor, not doctors. But, you know, 1945, I think the highest marginal income tax rate was 94%.
Wow.
When Reagan left office, it was 28%. I mean, that's a big change. In 1976, I think every state except one, and that was Nevada, had a state death tax. Now only a few states have state death taxes. If you look at it, right to work is now quite common amongst the states. Some states have reversed themselves on it. But I think we're making very major progress, although God knows it's not even, it's not smooth. You know, you get five steps forward and then you push back three or four steps and then you have to run again. But I think we are moving in a very positive direction in this world. And, you know, soon I think we'll be able to either replace the Fed or get a private set of monies that will really take over instead of the Fed. I love this stuff called Bitcoin. I love gold. I think those are very good units of account. So, you know, on balance, I'm pretty excited about the world.
Yeah, I can't imagine people understand what it would be like to have to live on 4 to 6% of your income. I know the British rock and roll people like the Rolling Stones and Eric Clapton, they moved to New York and America to actually keep more of their income because it was that onerous of a 90% plus tax rate there too.
The Beatles while ours was also wrote that song, The Tax Man.
Right.
You know, 95, 99 for me, one for you, I think it was. Wasn't that the line in there? You're young to remember those hip lines.
Oh, I do. Yeah, no, it's true. Let me play a clip for you. It's super short, 40 seconds. Hopefully Steve has it teed up there. It was in the email with everything else. And get your reaction. Would that be okay?
I'd love it.
All right, this is the guy.
Ours was the first revolution in the history of mankind that truly reversed the course of government.
Back there, Steve.
And with three little words. We... the people. We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us. We the people are the driver. The government is the car. And we decide where it should go and by what route and how fast. Almost all the world's constitutions are documents in which governments tell the people what their privileges are. Our constitution is a document in which we the people tell the government what it is allowed to do. We the people are free. Ours was the first revolution.
So, Dr. Laffer, why is Reagan the only one in my lifetime to ever say something like that? Why didn't George Bush and Dick Cheney carry that forward? And why do we have a split Republican Party now with a very small Freedom Caucus and a very large, what some call establishment, some call rhino, folks who could pass this $1.2 trillion omnibus yesterday? Pretty much selling us down the river when Reagan told him, with your help, how to do this.
You almost had me cry with listening to that. You know, I could just hear it right there in the room with me. I spent a lot of personal time with him. And, you know, he wasn't always that way, by the way, Steve. I mean, you know, when he became governor in 1967, he took office there. And the first thing he did was he tried to raise taxes, and he succeeded. He raised the highest income tax rate from 9% to 11%. He raised the capital gains tax rate, California, from 9% to 11%, raised the corporate tax rate again. The same thing, 9.2 to 11.2. I may have those a little backwards. He was the biggest social spender of any governor of California back then, in the history then. He chaired the Equal Rights Amendment, if you remember that. Mm-hmm. And also, I mean, he was pro-choice. He passed all of these he got rid of all of the anti-abortion statutes in the state of California. Here was a man who was not born in a manger. He was not born under a secret, you know, religious star. It's not sort of God imbued. He learned as he went along. And what he did was he looked at what happened. He saw what happened and he made a judgment whether in fact this was right or wrong and what caused it. And if you read it, and Marty Anderson wrote that book, Reagan in His Own Hand, and you can see how Reagan evolved to become the greatest president I think we've ever had. And, you know, it's an amazing story of knowledge, of creation, of public service that I've ever seen. He had been head of a union called AFTRA and SAG that had the largest industry-wide strike, and he was the president of that union at that time. Calling that strike. I mean, how could that guy be the biggest lover of peace that ever was? But he was, Steve. And I watched this man personally go through these transitions, and it was just beautiful. And you know, you make me want to cry when I hear those latter statements of Ronald Reagan's, because, you know, as governor of California, he was a much more angry man than he was as president. Reagan was the guy of the big tent. Everyone, come join us. I mean, you're transgender and you like tax cuts? Come on in. You've got a seat at my table. If you're tall and like those, come on in. If you like tax cuts, you got a seat at my table. Black, white, it didn't matter. All he wanted was prosperity and growth and happiness and freedoms, as he said it. I don't think of it as freedoms myself. I think of it as really the biggest freedom is low taxes, which is your freedom to earn your income and keep it and do with it as you want. But Reagan was totally into that by the end of his career. And I just loved it. Look at that 1986 Tax Act. Let me tell you what he did. He dropped the highest marginal income tax rate from 50% to 28%. All right? He raised the lowest tax rate from 12.5% to 15%. He went from 11 brackets to 2 brackets. He dropped the corporate rate from 46% to 34%. I mean, can you imagine that bill in Congress today?
Well, no, and he did it with Tip O'Neill as the Speaker of the House, a Massachusetts Democrat.
Don't buy into that. That is not a true statement. Yes,
wasn't there?
I mean, he made jokes about Tip O'Neill all the time, and they weren't flattering. The budget is big and fat and out of control, just like the Speaker of the House. And, you know, the Democrats are like drunken sailors. They spend like drunken sailors, but the only difference is that drunken sailors are sober the next day, and the money they spent was their own money. And, you know, he went after, it was Ronald Reagan, and he did it. You know what the vote was for that bill in 1986 in the Senate? I'm going to just give you the Senate vote. 97-3.
Nice.
Unheard of. The three voters against it, that like guy Simon, Paul Simon, you know, from Illinois,
yeah,
the bow tie guy.
Remember.
Levin from Michigan. And then there was Merkley, I think it was named, was the senator from Montana at that time. I mean, who voted for it? Teddy Kennedy voted for it. Bill Bradley voted for it. Joe Biden voted for it. Al Gore voted for it. I mean, and why did they all vote for it? Because it was the right thing to do. It was the right thing to do. We just have gotten off track. We're sort of cattywampus with the world. And if Reagan were back here, he'd be able to pull them all in and talk to them and explain it to them and get it right and get it done right.
And also, wasn't 140% of GDP as our national debt at this point, and rising every second. We're over $1 trillion a year in interest expenses alone. Maybe every 100 days a new $1 trillion is created. So different time, obviously, but you run today the Laffer Center for Supply Side Economics, lower tax rates to increase after tax return, right here in good old Nashville, Tennessee. Tell everyone as simple as a cocktail napkin what supply side is versus demand side.
People respond to incentives is what supply side is. You know, they like things they find attractive, and they are repelled by things they find unattractive. And taxes make things less attractive, and spending makes things more attractive. And if you look at what has been going on, these people have been raising taxes on workers and producers and paying people more money to be unemployed or not working or low income. I mean, it's shocking, and you shouldn't be surprised if you tax people who work and you pay people who don't work, that you're going to get less people working and more people non-working. And that really is just a response to incentives. You know, to us, people don't work because they're jobs. People work to get paid after tax. And that's our view of the world, very different from the Keynesian, what you would call a liberal left-wing governments that exist almost everywhere. To us, people don't save because their incomes are high. They save because they make an after-tax rate of return. Now, we have a big problem here in Tennessee, let me tell you. Our property taxes are not constrained in any way, shape, or form. They're unbridled, and the House and the Senate is unwilling to put in a cap like they did in California. Prop 13 is a cap, and I'm terrified.
Which they repealed.
Guys, huh?
Which they just repealed.
Yeah, well, there you go.
Which will devastate the seniors, yeah.
I mean, I am really worried about property taxes here. Memphis, of course, has the highest property taxes of any place in the state, and which is the one place that's broke and has the worst economy. And Davidson County, as you know, Nashville, in 2020, I think it was 2020, had a 34% property tax increase. And as you can see, the growth rate of Davidson County has dropped, stopped dead. Property values are rising at much slower rates now and all of that. So I am worried about this state. I would love to get your help and your support in getting through an initiative that we can get. I tried to work it through with the Senate and the House, but they are so beholden to cities, counties, and local districts and the sort of the political plums of these guys. And if you think of who's running a city and that they have the right to tax all the properties, those properties don't have a chance of leaving the city. They don't. We need to put constraints on those people. The way they did it in California is no property tax can exceed 1% of market value. Property tax bills cannot increase by more than 2% per annum. I mean, that's the way it should be. Do you realize these petty people in cities, counties, and local districts can lobby the state with taxpayer-funded lobbyists working against the taxpayers? Did you know that?
I did know that. Yeah, I've had shows on it.
Just shocking. I mean, and here you've got all these assessors when, in fact, we know what the property values are. My good friend, George Zillow, I just go to Mr. Zillow and he tells me exactly what every property is worth. We don't need these guys. We don't need this arcane process of assessments and stuff. So I would love it if someday we get together and we can do something really serious to do that. Now, I got shut down in the House and the Senate this time. I'm going back next year on it. Don't worry.
I'm with you. But just send me those proposals on email and I will get them done to the right eyeballs. Absolutely. Promise.
Well, we will do that in 2026 when we have a governor's race and we have all the House members up and all the Senate members up. That's the time we go in. I'd like to raise some money. I'd like to do it and make sure we cap property taxes here in the state to make sure that all of our generations, Ronald Reagan's century from now, is really true. Now, Prop 13 in California is the one saving grace California has. It really is amazing. They have made it so that there's one breathing hole that this whale survives. If they got rid of Prop 13 in California, they'd turn into West Virginia. A warm one, mind you, but they turn into West Virginia.
And we're about to find out.
They did that. And we need that here in this state. And I'm very disappointed with the legislature, and especially the Republicans. They know better than this, but they're just pandering to groups in the local groups, and it's just not the right thing to do. And we're just going to keep going until we get them. I mean, we get it right. It's the right thing for the people.
Yeah. Well, I'm on the train with you. I was born into the era of Prop 13, and I know exactly how it was exactly right. It was probably the one and only silver lining in that state as everything went bad. But let me get to this point.
Well, you know, I was very involved in Prop 13 in California.
I do. And this for the nation. In 1976, the big difference from 1980 was you. In my opinion, one of those ideas that Reagan used when he won election 4 years later in 1980, which in most historical precedent, he should have been has been, but he came back and won a landslide in 1980 because to enshrine freedom was your Laffer curve. I've read a lot of history of the Reagan era, and you were called the father of supply side economics at that time in history. Once Reagan embraced the tax cut plan that Ford didn't, he got Congressman Kemp to switch to Reagan. People remember Kemp from football, but he was a very important congressman. Dolan Kemp formed a ticket against Clinton, and most of us Republican watchers knew that was a political move, very cynical, of two very different economic versions. You had said George Bush Sr. was that sandwich, same guy. In the party at a time when Ross Perot was making the case for less debt and less globalization. So that meeting at the Continent Bar with you and Rumsfeld and Cheney, who were with Ford in 76, that was our country's bicentennial, ironically enough, to me seems like the start present at the creation, if you will, the name of Dean Acheson's book of New World Order, start of today's establishment versus Reagan era revolution Republicans, Reagan revolution, culminating in big government, Bush Jr., VP Cheney, and the record tax expansion and debt, not Reagan. No one ever before had figured it out. You cut taxes, you get more productivity and therefore more tax revenue, lower taxes, more government revenue. The stats prove it for Kennedy. Administration did it. Reagan did it. They both did it. Do you agree with all that?
Not with all of it, but a lot of it. And I loved it, by the way. Thank you very much. You give me way too much credit, number one. And thank you very much for doing that. If my mom were alive, she would be just so, so happy. And my dad actually would have believed you. So they're just joking. But I was involved with all of that. I was involved with Reagan. Let me give you the difference. In 1976, he had a debate He had a debate in New Hampshire, if you'll remember, with Jerry Ford and all that. And they asked him about his tax cuts and how would you fund him? And he said, I'm going to get rid of waste, abuse, and fraud. In 1980, he had that famous debate where he said, I grabbed the microphone and said, I paid for this, damn it. I mean, you know, you remember that one?
Oh, yeah.
They asked him about his tax cuts and how he would pay for his tax cuts. He said, what do you mean pay for my tax cuts? We're going to create more jobs, more output, more growth, more employment, and we're going to have less tax sheltering. We're going to have less people on the unemployment rolls. There'll be less spending, and it will pay for itself in due course. That is the difference. As you said, that is exactly what it was. And that was the sort of the epiphany of Ronald Reagan becoming the new Ronald Reagan. As I told you, this man learned. And I mean, if you see Reagan in his own hand by Marty Anderson, you can't imagine. He wrote a couple thousand words every day outlining what he learned from that day. And this man was astounding. I used to tease him. I mean, I knew him very, very well, obviously, and I spent a lot of personal time with him all the time. But I used to tease him. I said, now, remember, sir, when you were governor, I know, Arthur, when I was governor, I didn't do it right. I was wrong. But at least I was better than those other damn governors. At least I changed my mind when I made a mistake. And he did. And that was the love of Ronald Reagan. And he was a gentleman, kind, nice, sweet. All of his kitchen cabinet were bully CEOs of companies, you know. Blah, 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 blah. I mean, you know, but Reagan was just spectacularly nice to be with all the time.
Yeah, Schultz and Baker, I met. I wouldn't want to get cross with those guys. They were rough.
They were rough. George Schultz was my mentor throughout my whole life. He hired me 5 times. He never learned what a mistake it was to hire me. He hired me at the University of Chicago. Then he took me to the OMB, where I was the chief economist when it was formed. Then I went to as his consultant, the Secretary of Treasury. And then I went and became on the Reagan's PPAB, President's Economic Policy Advisory Board, with George as chairman. And then, of course, on the Governor Schwarzenegger. George was chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors for Schwarzenegger, and I was on that as well. So I've done nothing but do. And George was a very tough, hardline, but the best human being you'll ever find.
Yeah.
You know, he wasn't a laugh a minute. He didn't. I saw him smile once, but when I looked a little bit more closely, it was gas pains. You know, but George Schultz was the preeminent public bureaucrat in the nicest sense of the word. You know, he was the defender of the faith, the defender of do what's right all the time. And yeah. I just loved it. And Reagan and Schultz as a team were just devastatingly wonderful.
True. Now, and that's good, because behind the scenes, that's what you want. And then you want somebody who can, you know, smile and shake your hand in the retail politics world. So with a magic marker, you drew the now world-renowned curve. Kind of like Paul not having the Gospels to rely on when he preached. Nobody knew what the unheard of before unnamed laffer curve was. How'd you come up with it? Was it the JFK tax cuts that inspired you?
Not so much, really. I mean, maybe they did. I was a JFK Democrat, as you know, and I was a Clinton Democrat, and I did Jerry Brown's flat tax when he ran for president in 1992. I was his economist. And, you know, I've always been into supply side growth economics. And when I taught my classes, I had these sort of arcane mathematical models. It's called the ellipse, and it was a six-factor model. And all of these equations had things come out. And what I tried to do was take segments of those equations and make them pedagogically understandable. And one of the things was taxes. If you raise tax rates to 110%, so that every time you go to the office, instead of getting a check, you get a bill, sooner or later, you're going to quit working, and there'll be no revenues. Well, if you cut tax rates to zero, again, you'll get no revenues. And then, of course, as you raise them from zero on up, the revenues will start coming up. If you cut them from 100% on down, the revenues will start going up, and you'll show through this shape of the laffer curve, sort of my profile after a big meal, if you know what I mean.
And so like Hitchcock,
Yeah, and so, yeah, Alfred Hitchcock. Exactly, that's what it was. You remember the sort of silhouette that he did? Yeah,
sure.
That was exactly it. And if you look at it, it's a very easy concept to understand with that curve. And I've always tried to make things simple enough so that even a congressman can understand. And they did, and they saw it, and it clearly. And then once you see it, you can't unsee it. It's like that Where's Waldo? Yeah. Remember that silly thing with all the pictures? Where's Waldo? Once you see where Waldo is, you got it. And that's what I did with this, and it really worked. And, you know, the tax bill, we passed the 81 Tax Act with a huge majority as well. And in the 86 one, which was completely the Laffer curve effect, I mean, completely, we cut all tax rates across the board, but we got rid of deductions, exemptions, and exclusions, which was the Laffer curve effect of sheltering your income. When we did that, we got the 97 votes in the Senate. That they understood the Laffer curve back then, but since then, they've gotten a little senile. Joe's not quite the same as he was in 1986, and so he's forgotten all about it. Now he wants to tax the hell out of the rich. Which
there
is
was
about
a
the
similar
dumbest.
There was a similar version of this with Trump with the SALT deductions, the state
Exactly.
and local tax exemptions, so that a state like California that overtaxes can't deduct it from federal anymore, which was supposed to incentivize them to reduce it. So that night at the bar, both camps, Ford and Reagan, rejected it, from what I understand, but it became the fundamental basis for Reaganomics after 1976. So what Bush Sr. called voodoo economics, do you agree with that place in history for your sketch? And
pretty
also
close, pretty close. It was probably a little bit earlier where they did the sketch. The 76 was the campaign that followed the 70. They say it's 1974. Now, like a joke, you know, if you ever had a good joke and everyone laughs?
Sure.
Don't you retell it all the time?
Yeah.
Yeah, same thing with the curb. Once people said, God, that's neat. All I did is every place I went, I did a napkin and a curb. And I have no recollection literally where I did it, when, and at which time.
So you didn't keep it for the Smithsonian or anything? Like a
There
a
is actual... one in the Smithsonian. And they claim it's the real one. And I'm not going to deny it. But it's funny how I dedicated it to Don Rumsfeld in really neat, tight print years later. But no, that's fine. It's a great legend. It's very nice to have it in the Smithsonian. Don Rumsfeld is one of the finest people I've ever known in my life. I just adored him. And Dick Cheney, as I told you, is one of my classmates at Yale and one of the finest guys I've ever known as well. When, you know, he's just, they were just great. They were on the wrong team. They were on the Bush.
So you agree it is one of the main focal points of the Great Divide in the Republican Party.
Okay. And it started much earlier. It started with Taft and Rockefeller, Bob Taft and Eisenhower. My mom was a delegate at the convention in 1952. I think she was an alternative there. And that was the big battle between Eisenhower, who was a tax increaser, and Taft, who was a tax cutter. And then shortly after that, Taft died. And then you got that came in with the Bush and the Rockefeller people. And, you know, Reagan was, unfortunately, with the tax increases, Barry Goldwater is a tax increaser. And then all of a sudden, Ronald Reagan came. And as I mentioned before, the clouds parted, the sun shone forth on the earth, the flowers blossomed, the trees put more fruit.
But more than that, you got Jack Kemp, like I said, congressman from Buffalo, ex-football hero, the curve. And it ended up in Jack Kemp's job creation bill. And Reagan embraced the revolutionary concept. How did you get Reagan to focus on it? You know, I love that
line. Oh, you
really
want to know that truth?
Well, I love the line that Ford and Reagan both played football, but Reagan said he played with a helmet on. So maybe Ford wasn't so bright, I guess, even though they knocked Reagan for being an
amateur. Can you handle the truth? Okay. We were done. Kemp had something called the Kemp Capital Accumulation Act, which was sort of a Keynesian type of spending on investment and doing all that stuff, not really cutting taxes. And it wasn't great. And I spent a lot of time with him. And obviously, I went through the 30% tax rate reduction, which was John F. Kennedy's tax cut, and trying to do that. And it was a battle, and all these other people wanted to redistribute income. You know, Republicans weren't Republicans back then. They weren't free, freedom-loving people like we are. And I was trying to get him to come with us, and I just couldn't do it. And finally, I realized it. Do you know what Jack Kemp's middle name was?
Nope.
French. So I said, this is JFK2. Oh wow. And you know, he just lit up like a summer light. I mean, it was just beautiful. And he loved that, being JFK II. And
Wow. Damn,
he loved it. He did it. And God, did he do a good job. You know, he was an usher in my wedding at the Beverly Wilshire Hotel. And an usher there, and one of my best friends I've ever had. Just what a terrific guy. And by the way, he was smart as all get out.
That for sure, yes.
You know, and so was Reagan. They weren't academic smart. Jack Kemp was pretty good in all the ways of it. I mean, but they were really knowledgeable, smart in the way they learned, and they understood it. And it was just terrific seeing the progress that we made in that era. I mean, I remember being in the 70s and people saying, you and Jude Winiski and Jack Kemp, you want to cut taxes, you're going to cut them by 30%. That's the silliest thing we've ever heard. My God, we cut them way more than that. We got the tax rate down from 70% to 28%.
75%.
You know, just there's no amount of accomplishments you can't achieve if you just stay to it and have it and be right. Don't defend things that are wrong, and don't attack things that are right. And you know, when I've never taken a job in politics ever since the Nixon administration. I was George Shultz's right hand person, as you know. But I found I didn't like being in government. And the reason is very simply, and I can look at my colleagues now with Biden, and they were with Obama and even Bill Clinton and stuff. These guys who went to work for the government, they will rebut arguments they know to be true in order to defend, in order to get their benefactors' blessings.
Yeah. So more of a debating society than doing what's right.
Yeah, but because, you know, once you take a job, you're an employee, and you have a duty of loyalty to do what your boss wants you to do. And that's not what a good economist should do. I mean, Reagan, in a number of occasions, I've got a couple letters in my wall here where he was really ticked off at me. By the way, Reagan, when he's ticked off, is still the sweetest guy in the world. But, you know, I said, you know, don't you think you've raised taxes up with a 5 cent per gallon gas tax? And then he had the tax on Social Security he raised. There were a couple of others he did. And I said, don't you think you've raised enough taxes? But I could say that to him because I wasn't his employee. I wasn't Donald Trump's employee, so I could actually do a lot of the work of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. You know, once you become an employee, the guy says this and you do it. I didn't have to do that. But now, do I want to make him happy? You're darn right I do. But how do I make Trump happy? How do I make Ronald Reagan happy? How do I make George Shultz happy? You make him happy by giving him the truth. I mean, as you see it.
Make him look good,
a lot. Don't think for a moment that I'm not wrong. A lot I am, but I'm never wrong deliberately.
So let me real quick rewind a little bit. 1964, Reagan expressed support for Social Security to be voluntary for the health of the system, but switched that opinion later. And stock market investment instead of low rate bonds is what he was talking about. Did you ever have an opinion on growth investments as a way to save Social Security?
Yeah, well, you know, I'm for privatized accounts. I mean, you know, defined benefit plans, IRAs, KEOs, all of these where the money you put in is the money you're able to get out. And that makes some sense for sure that you have a defined benefit plan and privatized accounts. I don't think they should be specially tax treated, by the way. I don't think so. You should be responsible for what you do and for what happens to you in the future. And I think that would be a good thing for us to do right now. Switch over to private accounts.
Might be too late.
It's never too late. It's never too late. You can't do that to me. We're going to be here 300 years from now.
I hope you're right.
Just raise your eyesight over the mountains. And, you know, we may not make it all in 1 week or 1 month or 1 year, but if we make little nibbles and stuff, what I tried to tell you was in 1945, the highest marginal income tax rate was 94%. It's now 37%. In 1962, the highest corporate rate was 52%. It's now 21%. We're making huge progress in the states and on the federal level. It's just never going to be perfect, but we keep going for that North Star, and we will win. That's why I need your help here in Tennessee to get property tax caps. Right away, they're going to just run us into the ground.
Yeah. But, well, let me ask you this then, because it's you are the guy to ask, I believe. Shining city on a hill, right?
That's it.
Exact opposite of the WHO. In May, less than 2 months away, maybe three, we are looking at and talking about handing our sovereignty over to a global committee that, like communism, more than a shining city on a hill of Camelot or JFK's illusion, our cities aren't shining like San Francisco and Chicago. Baltimore just had a bridge collapse today. Not lined with gold, but lined with feces illegal. Okay. So how can the Laffer curve exist in a place without a Bill of Rights Because if the WHO does rule the world, it's a prison planet, not a place with a First Amendment, which made us so great in the first place.
I understand your fears and your concerns very much. The Laffer curve is not an ideological thing from the right or the left. It's math. And it's strictly math. Can I have a few seconds to go through the transfer theorem with you?
Yeah.
This is where it all comes down. The transfer theorem is when you take from someone who has a little bit more and you give to someone who has a little bit less. That's your communist committee, left wing, whatever you want, socialist, all that. Now, this is math. Now, this is not Republican or Democrat, liberal or conservative, left wing or right wing, socialist or capitalist. This is just plain math. When you transfer from someone who has a little bit more to someone who has a little bit less, by taking from someone who has a little bit more, you reduce that person's incentives to produce, and that person will produce a little bit less. With me?
Yep.
By giving that to someone who has a little bit less, you provide that person with an alternative source of income other than working, and that person, too, will produce a little bit less. With me?
Yes, sir.
I mean, if you tax people who work and you pay people who don't work, you're going to get less people working and more people not working. We're all together?
Yep.
That's math. That's not ideology. Whenever you transfer income, you always reduce total income. That's math. I don't give a damn if you're tall, short, fat, skinny, Democrat, Republican, liberal, gay, straight. It doesn't matter. That's math, and that's what happens. That's a math theorem. Now, this dilemma from this theorem is sort of cool, and I'm not going to prove it verbally like I did the theorem to you. The dilemma from this theorem is really cool, and I'm just going to state it, and I think you'll see it's true. The more you redistribute, the greater will be the loss in total income. And that's the dilemma from the theorem. Now, the limit function of the theorem is beautiful. It's got a piquant flavor that just makes my eyes water, and it's lovely. If you were able to redistribute all income so that everyone comes out exactly the same, there will be no income whatsoever. Now, let me prove that to you, because I got to show it to you so your podcast watchers can see this intuitively. In order to get complete redistribution of income so we all come out the same, what you have to do, Steve, is you have to tax everyone who makes above the average income 100% of the excess. And if you subsidize everyone below the average income, up to the average income. You with me?
Yep.
Now, if you actually did that, if you actually taxed everyone above the average income 100% of the excess, and if you actually subsidized everyone below the average income up to the average income, I will stipulate today that we'll all come out exactly the same at zero income, period. Incentives work for commies. They work for capitalists. They work for tall people, short people, old people. People will bend over and pick up a $100 bill when they walk down the street. There's one sitting there. And when a pretty girl walks by, we all look. I mean, incentives really work. And they work. And that's why these socialist WHO committees and stuff never will succeed. They never will overcome us. They can't, because all of them inside it don't believe in it. You know, I took them. There was a big rally at Harvard's sociology department a couple of years ago. Bernie Sanders was screaming and thing. Elizabeth Warren was shouting and blah, 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 blah. And AOC was in the front page, drooling. And I had a bag full of pillows full of $20 bills. All right. And I stood on the little wooden chair. And just when Bernie Sanders quit on the green there and there was a light wind blowing, I flopped this pillow sack full of $20 bills. And the $20 bills floated over the audience there of socialists, Fabian socialists. And within 30 seconds, they were all picked up. Even left wingers and socialists respond to incentives. All we need to do is create the proper incentive structure, and we'll just beat them every time. We'll beat them like a borrowed mule. And, you know, it's just, and they don't have a chance against us.
Yeah.
Believe me when I tell you that. Now, do you think we'll get everyone everywhere at all times? No. But they don't have a chance. They don't have a chance in the Soviet Union or China either. Now, the government can do a lot of damage. But believe you me when I tell you, incentives operate on the streets in China to an extreme you couldn't imagine.
Survival of the fittest. Okay, I got time for one more.
Sorry, but didn't mean to blather so long.
No, this is your show. So my son is out west in Arizona for college. He'll have to graduate into the next president's economy, like many kids today. Your son went to Arizona for college too. Arthur B. Laffer Jr. is a Tengler Investments based in Nashville.
That's yes, sir. God, you're good. You are really good.
Yeah, I think it was acquired by St. Louis firm, but he is going to carry your economic model as an economist one day, obviously. I've seen him on CNBC, very sharp. Congratulations on such a wonderful heir.
I got six of them, by the way. He's great. I love him dearly, and he's smarter now. You're right.
Awesome. Excellent. Excellent. So I just wanted to have you give him a little shout out, tell everyone what's to expect from the Laffer name in the future, and then I'll let everyone figure out how they can follow you and social media.
Six kids, 14 grandkids, and four great grandkids is what I've got. If I can't overcome the liberals, I'm just going to outpopulate them. That's all. I'm going to use the Amish Mormon model.
Amen.
Very nice. All right. Well, we are at the end of our time here. So
Thank you,
tell
Steve.
everyone where they can go to find out more about you, follow your social media, anything coming up.
I've got a flip phone, as I showed you. I don't know what to do. The Laffer Center, you can look me up, Google me, Google Laffer, and you'll find something there and get to me.
Do you have a new book
But I don't
coming
know how
out?
to Google.
Do you have a new book coming out?
I do. I do. We're going to do. It's not got a great title yet, but it's going to be the how-to books, how states can get rid of their income tax, can limit their property taxes, can put in price transparency, can put in enterprise zones, can put in school choice, and get rid of the parasitic leakages on the government process. That's what it is. And we probably got 90% of the way to the first draft, which is probably half the way to the book done. I would guess we'll get it out beginning of next year.
Okay, very
But it's going to be
timely.
great.
Well, I missed you at the Lincoln Day dinner here, but I will hope to see you very soon because we all are neighbors practically. So thank you for coming on. I hope to have you on
Anytime. We'd
again
love to have you as
sometime.
a guest here in the house. I hear in our office. Be great.
I look forward
Thank
to that.
you.
Thank you.
I know.
This is international film and television star Nick Searcy, and you're listening to the Mill Creek View, Tennessee podcast.
I don't understand how you ever did without me. I don't understand how I bring you down to your knees.
Wow,
welcome to the
Steve.
Steve and Steve segment of our show. Producer Steve, what did you think of our guest, legendary economist Art Laffer?
Oh, we could spend a whole another 20 minutes just you and I talking about that man.
I
And
have 8 pages that went unasked because
we
he
what
was a wealth of information.
what I what I took away from that was just a couple things that I want to share with the audience is good men, when they choose the wrong side, can do a lot of damage. I think Rumsfeld and Cheney are some of the wicked men of this world, but I know too much about the 9/11 event. But they're brilliant. They really know what they're doing. And he did make mention that they chose the wrong side. They chose the and men throughout history who have very good talent, who have very good skill sets, who understand things. Jesus said, if the blind beware, they're blind. Remember, they get blinded by ideologies and they'll do a lot of damage. And so that was one takeaway. The other thing I took away was I love his optimistic idea. I'm the same way. I believe we're going to keep going over that hill. That I know so many people who are having more kids now, and they're not buying into what's going on. But remember, you and I both know fear sells a lot of papers. It makes a lot of eyeballs. But I love what he says, that the who is not going to withstand the long term because it can't. It will crumble. Even the Soviet Union went away and is now replaced. So I loved his optimism. And man, what a wealth of stories. We could have sat here for 3 hours and heard the stories. And Steve, the third thing I want to say is you do your homework. It's always a pleasure to sit here and go, where did Steve come up with this knowledge? This guy, he knows his stuff, and I know you do.
I do my best. I do my best. I mean, a guy like that is, I actually, to be honest, so everybody can kind of peek behind the curtain, is I read a 560-page book about the Reagan Revolution and all of the Art Laffer segments. I pulled questions that I've had burning on my mind, and there he was to actually ask them. So what can you ask for better than that?
Good job.
How much time are we into the show?
Oh, you know, we can run it just a little longer if you want.
All right. Well, the 2024 State of the Union Address was given by the 46th President of the United States, Joe Biden, on March 7th, 2024 at 9 p.m. Eastern Time in the Chamber of the House of Representatives to the 118th Congress. Now, of course, all the bogus press wanted to talk about was the rebuttal choice of Alabama Senator Katie Britt and her story about a mom immigrant being trafficked for sex at the border, and if it was true or not. It was true, but the timing was maybe a decade earlier. Guess Katie didn't know that. Anyway, one lie, or whatever, let's call it a, to be nice, torturing of the facts to make a point versus this headline. Biden lied 30 times during the State of the Union by Sean Fleetwood, thefederalist.com. President Biden has been known to tell some pretty outrageous lies throughout his political career. So it came as no surprise when old Sleepy Joe spewed out more than a few whoppers during his State of the Union address on Thursday. From foreign policy to the economy, there was almost no subject in which the president didn't lie to the American people. That's Sean Fleetwood's quote, not mine. In case you missed his dumpster fire speech, here's the definitive list of Biden's biggest Supreme Court, State of the Union falsehoods. I put the abbreviations there. There's a lot of them. I'm not going to go through 50 of them. Actually, there are 30 of them that he talks about. I will just hit some highlights. World security and Ukraine. Biden claimed the free world is at risk if the U.S. doesn't ship more American taxpayer dollars to Ukraine. There's literally no evidence to support this assertion. January 6th demonstrations. The president claimed that the January 6, 2021 demonstrations at the U.S. Capitol and concerns and lawsuits regarding the integrity of the 2020 elections, quote, posed the gravest threat to American democracy since the Civil War, end quote. Contrary to Biden's claim, the J6 events did not put American self-governance in jeopardy, nor did it expose Americans to risk like those experienced during World War I, the Japanese attacks on Pearl Harbor, or World War II, to name a few. COVID shots and cancer. Biden falsely claimed the COVID jabs are now, quote, being used to help beat cancer. 15 million new jobs. The president regurgitated the lie that his administration has created 15 million new jobs. That assertion is false, as Biden conflated jobs recovered after COVID lockdowns with actual new jobs created. U.S. inflation rate. Biden claimed the U.S. has the, quote, the lowest inflation rate in the world. Numerous countries currently have a lower inflation rate. Producer Steve, you feel like it's the lowest inflation rate in the world these days?
No.
The national debt under Trump. Biden stated that the Trump administration added more to the national debt than in any presidential term in American history. This is untrue. Democrats' favorite fact-checking outlet, PolitiFact, admitted that former President Barack Obama accumulated more debt than Trump. There's your inflation too, by the way. How many billionaires? The president claimed there are 1,000 billionaires in the U.S. According to Forbes, there are 735 billionaires in America as of 2023. I'd say it's okay to round up in a speech, but that's a quarter trillion dollars worth of billionaires he's creating out of thin air. All right. Last one. And you can go read all of them if you want at the Federalist.com. The idea of America. Biden ludicrously contended that America has, quote, never fully lived up to, end quote, the idea that, quote, we are created equal, unquote. Well, yes, we have. Stay tuned for my thoughts of the day.
My name is Tom Anko. I'm a freelance writer and a staunch conservative, and you're listening to the Mill Creek View, Tennessee podcast.
All right. right, it is time for my quotes for the day. Before I share, I want to remind everyone to subscribe to Mill Creek View Podcast for now. Just go to Rumble or Spotify or iTunes, search for Mill Creek View, and hit the subscribe button until Steve changes it. I really hope you like it. And you can join the conversation still at Mill Creek View on Twitter and Facebook anytime. This is the last week of mcview.us under my ownership. 4-1, April 1st, April Fool's Day, I become HeartlandJournal.com's Tennessee podcast. More on that next time. It is not true that Congress spends money like a drunken sailor. Drunken sailors spend their own money. Congress spends our money. Actually, Art Laffer said that, and he just said it on our show earlier. You want to prove that Milton Friedman is a fascist? It's easy. Quote him. Only you economists will understand that one. Art Laffer. You know, without China, there is no Walmart. And without Walmart, there is no middle class and lower class prosperity in the United States. Art Laffer. Government spending is taxation. When you look at this, I've never heard of a poor person spending himself into prosperity, let alone I've never heard of a poor person taxing himself into prosperity. And you can't have a prosperous economy when the government is way overspending, raising tax rates, printing too much money, overregulating, and restricting free trade. It just can't be done. That's it for this episode. That was Art Laffer. That's it for this episode. Thank you, Dr. Laffer, for coming on, reminding us what the playbook should look like for a prosperous capitalist country so we know if it's not used, it didn't have to be this way. Pure politics, this modern monetary theory. This is goodbye for now. I'm your host, Steve Abramowitz, still editor-in-chief of mcview.us today, but heartlandjournal.com next week. See y'all tomorrow, I think, maybe Thursday. I don't even know what today is. Peace in our time and definitely glory to God. Heartlandjournal.com is dedicated to glory to God. Hold up. I am a music producer now too. At the end of your podcast, listeners can hear it. It's by Hemp Meadows and Denim Sky, husband and wife duet and Nashville's Entertainers of the Year 2023, now and tomorrow. See you later. Listen to the sound of the American horn. Not free music on a Saturday night. Bring a smile to your face and a tear to your eye. Sing a song about the heartland, the only place I feel at home. Sing about the way a good man works until the daylight's gone. Like rolling thunder, Lord, I love the land there.
Any views or opinions represented on the podcast are personal and belong solely to the creator and do not represent those of people, institutions, or organizations that the creator may or may not be associated with in a professional or personal capacity unless explicitly stated.